Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 355 of the podcast. And I'm recording this early as this goes out on Christmas Day. So happy Christmas, wherever you are in the world, or happy holidays, or just happy day. So today I'm talking about the healthy writer with my co-author, Dr. Ewan Lawson. And we talk about the issues that writers reported in our survey, along with our own personal stories of health issues and recovery, plus tips for how you can make 2018 a healthy and sustainable creative year. And The Healthy Writer is available in ebook and print from the 28th of December 2017, so this week. And I really hope you find it useful. Writing the book has actually been instrumental in my own health journey this year, including giving up sugar. And my very personal letter to sugar is in the book. And both Ewan and I share personal stories. And so I really hope you find it useful. And let's become a healthy indie author community. So nothing extra this week except to say that today's show is sponsored by Drafter Digital, and I'll play the sultry voice of Kevin Tumlinson next. Thank you to everyone supporting the show on Patreon. I really appreciate your support, like the tweets and emails. It demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And of course, last week I did the Patreon only Q&A, and if you support the show, you will get the entire backlist and you'll get the extra monthly, every month Q&A, and have the chance to ask your own questions. So you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, so here's a word from our sponsor and we'll get on with the interview.
Hi, this is Kevin Tomlinson with Drafted Digital, bringing you the D2D Smart Author Tip number 3. Look, we know that marketing your books is one of the toughest parts of an author career. That's one of the reasons we built our Universal Book Links, or as we call them, UBLs. With a UBL, you can create a single, solitary link that will send your readers to everywhere your book is sold online. With a D2D account, you can customize your UBL to make it easier to remember, and even add affiliate links from Amazon, Apple iBooks, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, Google, and even Smashwords. I know, right? UBLs are evergreen, meaning you can update them with a single click anytime your book appears in a new storefront online. Since they're always up to date, you can use them on business cards, mailers, even in blog posts, social media posts, mentions on podcasts. That's a thing, right? And if you'd like to reach the widest possible audience, be sure to use Drafted Digital's free ebook distribution to major online retailers worldwide, including Apple iBooks, Kobo, Tolino, and more. Start reaching a bigger audience now. Convert your manuscript, distribute it online, and get the support you need the whole way at drafteddigital.com/pen.
Today, I'm here with Dr. Ewan Lawson. Hi, Ewan.
Hiya.
It's great to have you on the show. So very exciting day today. So Ewan is a British medical doctor and a fellow of the Royal College of General Practitioners. He's ex-British Army and enjoys fell running. He's also my co-writer for The Healthy Writer, Reduce Your Pain, Improve Your Health and Build a Writing Career for the Long Term. And we're so excited to bring it to you, aren't we, Ewan?
Yeah, I am buzzing a bit today already. It's not just the coffee. Yeah, I'm properly excited.
We are, and we think it's a good book, and today we're going to tell you about it. So start off, Ewan, by telling us a bit more about your background as it relates to writing, and also what kind of doctor are you, so people understand a bit more.
So as you said there, I'm a GP, a general practitioner, so that'll be familiar to people in the UK, in Australia and Canada. But in the rest of the world, it's not necessarily well known. And we might be known as a specialist in family medicine or family physicians. And so basically, we look after everyone outside of hospitals in the community. So it's kind of cradle to the grave stuff, from birth to babies, to kids, end of life, and everything in between as well. So and I've done a lot of work as well with people who have addictions in the past. particularly to alcohol, but heroin, crack, amphetamines, and people who inject drugs. So that's been a real kind of special interest of mine.
Yeah.
And I guess most of my medical writing has been, my writing has been medical in the past, and particularly related to those special interests as well, and about habits and addictions. So I've written for academic publications and textbooks, and I've just finished a textbook about burnout in doctors as well. And I'm the editor of a medical journal. So obviously there's lots of writing involved in that and editing. And we get lots of articles from people also about the experience, the lived experience of illnesses, whether it's from the doctor perspective or whether it's from the patient perspective as well. So lots of involvement on that medical side. I'm also a big fan of crime fiction, and I write a little bit of that myself, and I help out reviewing the Crime Fiction Lover website. So that's, I'm passionate about that. So that's a lot of fun as well. So my writing sort of crosses across the spectrum.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And then tell us, like, because you live in quite a cool place in Britain, and also just, you know, give us an indication of your family as well, because it's you, is it?
The great thing about these jobs these days is you can work remotely. And so even though the kind of medical journal and other things are based in London, I'm able to live up in Cumbria, which is just in the Lake District. So that's up in the northwest corner of England. And it is a beautiful place. And I mean, I don't know how well known it is globally, but it's a pretty fantastic spot. And I live on the side of a hill with my family, so I can get out running regularly. My wife enjoys the running out there, and I occasionally drag out the kids. But to be honest, it's more common for my my lovely Sprocker Spaniel Minnie to come with me. She's my regular companion, and she's the one that keeps me honest.
Yeah, which is awesome. And you have some lovely pictures of you running around the area, don't you? So that will give your website later, but it's really,
yeah, sure.
I think it's great to see that. So the book, The Healthy Writer, obviously, and we started off the book saying why writing is absolutely amazing for your health. And that's what I want us to start this interview with as well, because, you know, we will get on to some of the pain, but let's just focus first. So why is writing amazing for our health?
Well, I mean, there's a bit of medical evidence around this. And I think you're right. There's a real potential for us to portray it as always bad. And actually, most people just get an enormous amount out of their writing. And there's some quite good evidence for writing as therapy. I think you've written about, and I find personally, it gives you such great insight into your own thought processes and how that works with your own emotions. And that's the kind of basis of things like cognitive behavioral therapy. And so I see writing as kind of a start to those kind of, it's incredibly powerful. And there's some quite good studies that have shown, even with a simple thing like a gratitude journal, and even just once a week, writing down five things weekly. There were some California psychologists who had a great study that showed actually it really massively improved personal well-being, and people felt much better. And it wasn't just that they said they felt good, and it was kind of, you know, it was the family members noticed it as well. It was a really sort of objective thing. And so there's that kind of psychological mental health aspect to writing, which I think is great. But actually the research has gone a little bit further as well. And it can actually help your physical health. And I think because of those improvements in your mental health, that can improve your sleep. And getting your sleep right can be a bit of a superpower. And if you get your sleep wrong, it leads to a lot of problems, you know, stress, and that releases cortisol and other sort of hormones, which can damage your health in the long run. So actually writing can be really positive in terms of improving all those things. And if you're following your passion, it's hard to see how that's bad for your health anyway. I think it's tremendously good for you.
Exactly. It's funny you say sleep is a superpower. I mean, people always ask how I get stuff done, and I generally say because I sleep for like 8 or 9 hours a night. And then I'm so full of energy that I just get stuff done. But it also on the writing good for our health, like the social side, for example, you know, when I started writing in 2006, I knew nobody creative, like creative in the sense that, you know, now I'm in the center of this community, my own community and many others. And it's interesting because by putting our writing out in the world, whether that's books, journals, blogging, social media, we can actually connect with people like us, and that loneliness and isolation that some people feel is also mitigated.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I know we'll probably mention that a bit further on in terms of loneliness, because I just think it's one of those incredibly important aspects. And if you're connecting with people that is something you feel passionate about, you know, you connect with people at work or other things. But when it's your passion and you connect with people and make those and have those social interactions, that's amazingly good for you. And I think, you know, that really, you know, it's a real benefit.
Okay, so let's get into the survey then, because we had nearly 1,200 writers submit answers to the Healthy Writer Survey in August 2017. And there were some heartbreaking stories. I mean, we both read through reams and reams of stories about pain and problems. So what are the most common problems, you know, overarching that authors face? And did anything stand out for you?
Yeah, I mean, well, a few things. I mean, the first thing was it was an incredible privilege. And an incredible response from the community. So there was so much to go through, and people willing to share kind of like really difficult moments, and also sharing their hard learned lessons as well. And they did it with such generosity. That people have been through that pain and just wanted to actually help other people improve their health a little. I think there was a lot of stuff there I expected, which was back pain, shoulder pain, neck pain. There was a lot about inactivity and not getting moving enough, and people had gained weight as a result, particularly if they'd gone into being writers full time and had suddenly noticed. There were some very obvious stories about people who had suddenly gained weight and could see immediately the problems that their writing had given them. There were some things I didn't expect, which I possibly should have done, which things like eye strain and headaches and use of computers. And there were also a lot of stories and quite moving stories about mental health and the loneliness and isolation. I suppose they didn't surprise me, because I know that that's a big problem. But when you read about them, it's always more affecting. And particularly, I see, you know, as a GP, you see people one person at a time. And you see, yeah, when you actually then read about dozens of stories all along that theme, it was very affecting.
Mm. And we include a lot of the quotes that people gave us their permission for in the book. And some of the beta readers we've had have said that it's helped them feel less alone, because they realize lots of other people suffer this. And I think that's a big problem as writers. We spend so much time alone that we think, oh, this is just, you know, must be accepted and must be just me or whatever. But actually, there's lots of ways you can deal with it. So I did want to sort of look about some of the different things that we wrote, because it's not an academic book, and that was quite challenging for you, I think, and we'll come back to your writing process. Pain and health in layers is something that really helped me as we were writing. It's like, sure, your back hurts, but what might that mean? And I share my own 5-year journey of, you know, going through lots of different ways of dealing with back pain. So what have been some of your personal health issues over the last few years, and how did writing the book help you to sort of face up to them and sort of share that?
Yeah. So I guess I've been thinking about this through the book. And one of the biggest things for me has been exercise. And I've been very lucky in terms of my physical health, and I've not had any sort of significant problems. And I guess actually getting to the stage of writing this book is because actually some of the issues I've had, I've managed to address in some ways. I didn't come from a very active family. So I got into my 20s and didn't really have any process for doing exercise. Very podgy runner at school, generally humiliated in the school cross country. Though I was sort of did the sports, I was rubbish at running. But I always loved being in the mountains and being outdoors. And then when I got into my 20s, I really learned how to run and spent time with people who valued exercise in itself. And so kind of my personal health challenge is I learned how to exercise and how to enjoy running in particular. But what I couldn't do was make it a habit and do it regularly. And I just kept falling off the wagon, and I'd have 3 months where I'd do no exercise, and then you have to try to get back to it. And actually, so one of the biggest challenges for me has been making exercise, embedded in my life. It feels weird not to do it. And that is really in the last 3 or 4 years. And so writing the book, I've become very aware that's been my journey in terms of where I am now, and that kind of satisfaction and quality of life I get from being able to exercise regularly. Mm. I think in terms of challenges for the future, I have still not managed to sort my back out. Despite all the advice there and fantastic story about your back and your kind of your path to a pain-free back via yoga mostly. That's still one that I'm struggling to do. And I'm trying to get a habit, and I'm wrestling with that every day.
Well, that's interesting. And I just want to comment on food, because I have a letter to sugar in the book that is actually pretty hard for me to share. And it's quite personal. And, you know, we do talk about the weight gain, but it's hilarious we're having this conversation. And on the video behind you, I can see a box of Quality Street and a bottle of wine.
Yeah. I'd like to say they've been there for years, and the box is definitely empty. I've eaten them all.
And I think it's important to say that this is not a weight loss book at all. It's about health. And we do touch on weight because that is a problem that people have. But in no way, you know, it's about health. So we do have some stuff. But I just wanted to, you know, say to people, both of us enjoy our food and we enjoy, you know, eating stuff. So it's not like a lectury book. I hope people find it more useful.
Yeah, I certainly hope not. I think my diet can be diabolical at times, and I've a real problem with crisps. It's really my biggest failing.
Or what do they call them in America?
Chips.
Potato chips.
Potato chips. Yeah. That's my biggest failing. So yeah, absolutely. I that will never go away. But it's about managing those. It's about managing it, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's funny. Like, I've got some quotes in there about black coffee, and I'm standing here with black coffee. I mean, you know, and these things are fine, and it's about how we incorporate things in our healthy life. So just wanted to point that out. So coming back to, like I just said, I'm standing up. Both of us are actually standing up right now, aren't we?
Yeah, I'm standing,
Yeah, in our standing desks. And improving our workspaces is probably one of the most critical things, or at least something to start with. So, for example, with back pain, one of the things that to look at is your ergonomics, like immediately. Yeah. And I had terrible RSI for about 2 years that eventually was sorted with my back pain through yoga and various other things. So what are some tips for improving our workstation health?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned RSI, because we've obviously got a bit about it in the book, but I don't think it came up as much as we expected, perhaps in the survey as a problem. But I think that's because I think it comes up in other ways as well, in terms of back pain, shoulder pain, neck pain. It's all linked.
Arm pain. I don't know if people know. Yeah. RSI is repetitive strain injury, which is like a diagnosis of pain, isn't it?
Well, that's exactly, it doesn't say much more than that. You just get pain from doing something. And that's pretty much what RSI is. It's really not terribly sophisticated. But I think so you need a really holistic approach to that. And actually, hopefully, if you can not get it in the first place. So in terms of basic tips, using laptops is perhaps one of the things to be really careful of. They're fairly toxic in ergonomic terms, and they contort your body into horrible positions. And you look down at the screen when really you should just be looking more level or slightly down at your screen. So actually getting a riser or sticking it even on a few magazines or books is really good for your laptop, and using an external keyboard. So that's a kind of probably basic advice for laptops, which is really important because they can really hurt people. And then I think it's about things like your chair and your sitting position. You want to have a sort of a normal curve of your spine, if you can, where your lower back curves slightly in, and a generally relaxed position so that your head is just kind of looking straight across. Your arms are generally parallel to the floor, and not usually resting on the desk or the keyboard. They should just slightly be in a relaxed, neutral position, hovering above your keyboard. Feet on the floor can help, actually, rather than crossing your feet and sticking them out in front of you. That can be a helpful sort of just simple ergonomic tip. And a good chair will often help you achieve that and remind you. And some people use footrest as well to keep their feet in the right position. Mm. And I think that's all the sitting down side of things. There's a lot of good evidence around the standing desks and treadmills desks. And I was really struck by some of the evidence around this that showed that they can be really beneficial and improve well-being. The treadmill desks are really interesting, and with people actually showing improvements in their blood work, in their blood test result, having better their glucose improving, so less chance of diabetes, and their cholesterol levels improving. The only slightly weird thing about treadmill desk is trying to type when you're on one. Always seems like a desperate task. And that has been measured in the research as well. And it did show there is a slight reduction in typing speed and a slight reduction in your ability to kind of do complex tasks. But it was pretty minor. And probably the benefits of exercise would offset that anyway.
Yeah. And I think I interviewed Russell Blake, who is an incredibly prolific indie author. Mm. I think he walks on his treadmill desk like 8 hours a day, and he's writing the entire time. So I think and I've heard people say that you do have to start off walking very slowly, but that you obviously get used to it. But the treadmill desk is not practical for most people. Neither you or I actually have a treadmill desk, right? I mean, it's just, for me, it's not practical in a small apartment. And I also tend to write in cafes. So just I'll describe what I am doing right now. And in the blog post that goes with this, we're going to have some pictures of us in our various working positions. So I'm standing up right now, and I've got it's called a HumbleWorks stand. It's like a wooden stand. I did have a desk with a motor that went up and down, but the motor broke. So I love this wooden stand. So I've constructed it on top of my desk, and then I can take it down really easily. I have my laptop on top of it with the keyboard when I'm typing lower down so I can keep my posture. I've got a Swiss ball when I'm sitting, and I've got a footrest for my Swiss ball as well, to kind of, because otherwise you can, you know, I tend to cross my legs. And the Swiss ball, I do a lot of back bends over, and I find the actual arms over the head stretch is just critical for the pain I get between my shoulders, and which affected my RSI. Yeah. So that's basically my sort of setup. So tell people what your setup is, because when you're a GP, I mean, you're like, you know, at a desk as well.
Yeah, the GP is really awkward, and I actually often end up with a very sore back because I have met GPs who are starting to do some consultations standing up as well, or have a desk that'll go up and down because they're getting so many problems. And my desk here is at the university, and it is actually, it's a stand-up desk, but it's an old school desk, like looks like a Victorian thing for a children's school desk that I cut the legs off of. And I bought a chunk of MDF off of eBay.
What's MDF? And
MDF is like sort of this, you know, very thick fiberboard kind of stuff. So it's kind of a piece of wood. It's about an inch and a half thick. So it's really heavy. And I just plunked it on top. And I cut the legs to exactly the right height. And so I've got my arms in a nice neutral position when I'm at the keyboard, and the screen at the back of the piece of MDF. And then it's not bolted together in any way. It just sits there, and the weight just holds it in position. And if I try and lean on it, which is obviously bad anyway, it does move a little. So that discourages me from leaning on it, because otherwise my computer will fall off. So it cost me next to nothing, and it works really well. But I have it on the corner of the desk, so I can also vary my posture a little, because I think that's probably quite important. Some standing, I know that there's some evidence that if you're standing all the time, that can irritate your back as well. So a bit of variation in posture is really useful. So I've got the other end of my desk where I can sit normally. And I also have a Swiss bowl that I will then sometimes use if I just want a bit of a change with that as well.
That's fantastic. The
students laugh at me if I'm on the Swiss bowl, so I don't tend to use that so often.
Well, I think this is really good, because I mean, neither of us have a very expensive setup. I mean, the laptop's pretty expensive for most of us, but that's an important tool. But you can get these basic pieces of equipment to change things up quite easily. And I also wanted to check in with you on dictation, because we have a chapter on dictation in the book, and I certainly dictated like the first draft of what I was thinking for the book, and some of the chapters, you know, were based on a dictated first draft. So how about you? How have you felt with dictation?
I've been using it more and more in the past year, and all of my first draft stuff I dictated as well. So however many words that was, I did it all on dictation. Obviously, once I got past that stage, the dictation wasn't a problem. But I also moved very quickly away from dictating with the computer screen in front of me and went to mobile devices. And I found that really helped in terms of just getting into the flow of dictation and not correcting as you go, and your little inner editor starting to panic about things. And that's worked really well. And I run it off my Mac, just using I don't use Parallels. I use a free equivalent of Parallels to run Dragon on my Mac. And that's worked brilliantly. What I would say is I noticed that actually, interestingly, Dragon has incredible accuracy for medical stuff. And I think there's a professional version of Dragon, which is used by a lot of medics. I think not so much in Britain, but certainly overseas. And it recognizes all the medical words. It is absolutely, it's a ninja when it comes to medical stuff. So it worked really well.
That's awesome. If only they would do that for like fantasy novels. Because from fantasy authors, they're like, yeah, no, it's very difficult.
They must have a nightmare, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then like I've really noticed, like I felt in the writing of this, I have... like when I'm at the cafe, because I write fiction at the cafe, and I take the laptop and I am in a bad position. But what I've started to do a lot is try and stand up more in between. So if I'm editing, I'll stand up to read and try and ignore people looking at me now. No, because basically that's part of my process. And this is obviously very important in the book. What we're not trying to do is like, okay, you must do that. It's like, what are the ways in which you can improve your process so you're not suffering so much pain and you can do this for the long term?
Yeah. I think that's right. And I think the tip that came out through the survey almost all the time was about breaks and structured breaks. And so you do something a little bit different. And I think almost all of the problems that you can have writing, if you take a break, but people vary. So you need to find your own process, but say every 30 minutes, actually even stopping for a couple of minutes to stretch and particularly eye strain, or get your eyes away from the screen, not to use it to look at your phone, to actually do something a little bit different. Actually, really, that's really good to kind of I think that's a big part as well of a healthy process.
So, I mean, what was funny, well, not funny, it was kind of going to happen, is that it's not rocket science. We all know this, you know, that the evidence for good sleep, good diet, good exercise are important for health, resilience and longevity. And I think one of the things that I realized in doing this writing is that I've spent so long concentrating on what's above my neck, you know, the importance of my brain and just focusing on my brain. And my body was literally something that carries my brain around. And it just needs to carry my brain around. But actually, in reading a lot, yeah, I know it's crazy. But I really, and we talked about nootropics, which are drugs that can make your brain go faster and, you know, empower your brain. And what I learned from you and from doing all this is that if you sleep well, eat well and exercise well, you actually have a much better brain, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. They are good proven cognitive enhancers in that regard. They really improve your brain. I think you're right, but I mean, there is a danger this could be a very short book as well in terms of getting those things sorted. But we know what the good things are, and there's really good evidence for them, but it is tremendously difficult. And there is a bit of a paradox as well, because I mean, the secret to being a writer is getting your butt in the chair and writing, but the secret to being healthy is probably getting out of the chair and being active. So there is a bit of a contradiction there. So working at that is difficult. And most people know that stuff's bad for them. It's like smokers as well. You know, people know smoking's not good for them. You don't need to tell them. But actually stopping's a whole, changing your habits is a very different kettle of fish. Changing things that are deeply entrenched is really hard to do. And I think we have lots of pressures in the world around us to keep on doing the things we're doing, whether it's family or work or you know, and also just out in the world. And I've been felt very strongly about this, that actually the world is trying to make us consume as well, in terms of eating snacks and eating more than we're used to. And we need to push back against that a little. And we need to try and recognize what those habits are so that we can start to make some changes.
Yeah, definitely. The habit's a really good thing. I mean, you talk there about, you know, some of the things that we're encouraged to do. And I think what's become interesting in the indie author community is this emphasis on high production, which is stressing people out, and people are burning out. And you mentioned at the beginning working on burnout in doctors. So for those, you know, what are some of your tips for anyone feeling overwhelmed, burned out, losing that? And someone actually put in the survey that they were losing their love for writing because of this emphasis on production.
I think there's lots of different aspects to burnout, and there's lots of different ways to make yourself more resilient as well. And some of those good things we've talked about already in terms of your health will really make a huge difference to making you more resilient and less prone to burnout. I think the one thing I would probably point to is the problem of comparisonitis. And I talk about that a little bit more in terms of being active in the book, but it works for writing as well, of course, is that you really have to live your own life and on your own terms. And actually, that's part of the thing about the book, is not trying to tell you to do, you know, I talk about running a lot, but I don't think running is absolutely not the answer for everybody. The right exercise is the one you want to do. And I think you've got to probably take that approach to writing and burnout as well. Actually, comparisonitis is really toxic, and it can lead you into a very bad place. If you're doing something which works against you and doesn't fit with your normal patterns, that adds to stress, and all those stress levels, they lead to, you know, they affect your sleep, that affects your health. It makes it harder to do the right things. It makes it harder to make healthy habit changes as well. And so you can very quickly go down a very unpleasant little rabbit hole with that kind of process.
And also, I think one of the things we emphasize is trying to get in touch with your body more. And again, like, I feel that this is, yoga has helped me with this too, is this mind-body connection, which, as I pretty much ignored what my body was telling me. And, you know, my husband has always said, I don't stop until I hit the wall. And when I hit the wall, like, then I stop, because I'm forced to, or I suddenly get, you know, when I do get really bad headaches now, and they're quite rare, it's because I haven't stopped working for ages. And I love my work. I absolutely love what I do, but my health can suffer. So I think rest, and like you said, taking breaks is not just the 5 minutes in between working sessions. It's also, you know, a day off, a digital fast. It's a week off away from the computer. It's take Facebook off your phone.
Absolutely. And I think there's a balance to all these things. And I think people fear the loss of productivity. And I think there's certainly at least one quote in the book, if not others, about that somebody who's very anxious about that, time away from writing to exercise very rarely causes that much of a productivity impact. If it keeps you going longer, actually, when you come back to it and you're refreshed and you're working well, then actually you're going to be just as productive. You know, losing the sort of the few minutes to do those healthy things or to connect in some other way or to take a break and or to go out and be mindful. And mindfulness is a really growing evidence base for how useful that can be as well. And I think they can all help really build a writing habit, which you can sustain in the long term.
So what's interesting too is we don't just talk about physical health, we're also talking about mental health. And I was quite saddened by the loneliness and isolation that some people felt. And also a lot of people mentioned depression and anxiety, which is relatively common in the normal population, or I say normal population, in the population, right? And you talked about, you know, how some of, you know, comparisonitis brought up some anxiety for you. And I have a whole chapter on my mental health journey, I guess. And we have Dan Holloway, who wrote a great chapter.
Yeah, great.
I mean, he's bipolar, so he has, you know, depressive episodes, and he wrote a great chapter. We have stuff on chronic pain that often causes these things. So what are some ways in which writers can, I guess, identify and then help with this issue and find a community?
Yeah, so there's quite a big spectrum of possibilities there. And obviously loneliness is not a kind of end of the spectrum of depression and anxiety, but they're often closely linked. Mm. So I think one of the first things is kind of really identifying what your difficulties are in yourself. And so that kind of self-awareness thing, and writing itself can be really good for that, to actually work out what you're thinking and how you're feeling. And I know that it's been said that, you know, sitting is the new smoking, but really actually probably loneliness is the new smoking, really, in terms of it being really bad for your health to be socially isolated, not have a community. So there are some sort of simple ways you can go on. There's some simple questionnaires, but actually just thinking about whether or not you've got somebody you can confide in is an important aspect of whether or not you could be lonely. And then obviously we talk in the book about how you can find your community, how you could engage with people, friends, dating, other things in terms of getting out and meeting people and doing those sort of things. Depression and anxiety, that obviously that can be very closely associated with those. And there are, I think if things are obviously going too far the wrong way, then you're going to need to speak to a healthcare professional to kind of, then there may be other sort of more specific treatments that you need. And that's really important. But actually, sometimes at the lower levels, there's an awful lot you can do yourself. And so we mentioned writing there. Sometimes the talking therapies can be really helpful. And you can do some of the sort of cognitive behavioral therapies. You can do those. You can do them online. You can do them over the telephone. You don't actually have to go and see a therapist necessarily. So they're quite accessible, and they can be really helpful to establish how your negative thought patterns can impact on your emotions, can impact on your mood, and impact on sort of anxiety symptoms. But I think the number one thing about mental health problems, more than anything, is getting out there and speaking to somebody and recognizing it, and recognizing that you're not alone. Conversations I have time after time after time in the surgery to people that are mental health problems, and they feel guilty about having it. And they go, well, my life's not stressful, I shouldn't feel anxious. But it doesn't work. You know, mental health problems don't work like that. You wouldn't be saying that if you got a chest infection. Mm-hmm. It just happens. There are just illnesses that happen to some people. But and actually we see the numbers, whatever they are, 1 in 3 will suffer a lifetime problems or something similar, is that the surgeries are chock full of people who have the same problems but are not speaking to each other and telling each other they have the same problems. So you spend your life in the surgery going, listen, you're really, I've seen half a dozen people with this already today. This is, and actually trying to reassure people that what they're experiencing is okay. It does need some, you know, there are some specific actions in terms of getting some, whether it's talking treatments or even medication. Exercise is tremendously good. Doing all those sort of good things with cognitive enhancement, like exercise and, you know, being careful about alcohol in terms of how you use it. All of those things can really help push things in the right direction.
Mm. And I think this is part of what we're trying to do, is almost, you know, make people feel less alone in how they're feeling and try and open up these conversations. And I think we are coming into a point where, I mean, you and I have had this conversation, women are generally better at identifying these and talking things, and men often keep these things very quiet. And, you know, my husband, Jonathan, there's a chapter on IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, and anxiety. Yeah. And I was like so grateful that he was sharing that, because that's been a huge issue in our life. And the digestive system and anxiety are so closely aligned. And also with authors, you know, sometimes the unhealthy diet can exacerbate these things. So I hope that some of these difficult things to discuss, bodily functions, mental health, stuff that people hide, can be more talked about.
Yeah, well, the digestive chapter is definitely a little bit more sort of scatological in that regard. So we kind of, and it's a fantastic chapter from Jonathan. And I think, you know, really open and so important that I actually very rarely see that from particularly from men, as you say, you know, kind of that honesty. And I think it's just, if we can get it out there and we can talk about it, and actually we all know the stigma that is there with mental health and people often put it on themselves. It's not as well as other people from the outside putting it on them. If we can make people feel a little bit less alone and feel that it's okay to go and get help and look after that side of their health, then I think that's going to be, I'll be very happy.
Yeah, me too. Okay, so we are, as this goes out, we're coming into a new year, and it doesn't matter when you're listening, viewers or listeners, how can we develop healthy habits for the coming year and make some changes for the long term? Because what we don't want is the sort of new year, let's just give up alcohol and be dry for January and then essentially go back to all the unhealthy stuff. So how can we, what are some of your tips for that, the habits?
Yeah, so I think the important things about habits is to recognize that a lot of them, they can be very good. They're there to sort of free up our brains to do other things. But you've got to be very careful that you don't want to live all your life on automatic pilot. And actually, it's doing a little audit of those habits that's really important. And so that you kind of, sometimes you need to sit down and really identify what your bad habits are. So, because if you're doing them on automatic pilot, by definition, you're not even noticing sometimes that you're, in terms of why you're eating the snacks or why you're not getting the exercise or what's happening that's disrupting your sleep. And I think the new year thing is a real problem, I think, because you go out and you make sweeping changes and they're unsustainable. So more than anything, I think the thing to understand is you need to change habits in the long term. And changing habits is uncomfortable. It does trigger a bit of stress. You have that sort of cognitive dissonance where things don't feel quite right. It's even like if you have a holiday, have a day off, and then I'm at work on a Tuesday when I should have been there on a Monday. I feel a bit weird. It doesn't feel right. And that's because my habit's been disrupted. And so actually my tips on this is really to make small, sustainable changes. And then you have to be persistent and you have to be patient. And it's going to take weeks and it's going to take months for those habits to get ingrained as the new habits. And it's going to take a long time for the changes to come through. But you will then have hopefully sustainable changes to your lifestyle that you're not just going to bounce back again. I mean, there's a lot of good evidence about diets, for example, nowadays, and crash diets, that people tend to bounce back and put as much weight back on again afterwards. And so I don't think that's, when it comes to weight loss, that's certainly not a good approach. But when it comes to anything in terms of your health, I think small changes that you can sustain, incremental, that's kind of the way to go. But first of all, you have to have the awareness. You have to know what they are. And so you've got to sit down and try and work that out.
And it's interesting because, again, I put in the letter to Sugar, which I wrote in May 2017, mainly because I read a lot about the link with Alzheimer's. And I'm not scared of dying. I write about dying all the time. I'm scared of Alzheimer's and dementia because my whole life is around things I create from my brain. And I give to a charity on this. And when I read about the links between sugar and Alzheimer's and some of these things and the health issues beyond weight. So forget about weight. I just wanted to give up sugar.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But my habit, like one of our habits as a couple would be to have our dinner and then go and watch some TV. And we would have like half a block of chocolate each in front of the TV. And we would just do that like every night and not even think anything of it. And I was like, yeah, okay. So even just identifying that was a habit, sweet something in front of the TV after dinner as part of relaxing it was something that I need to do address as a habit, and Jonathan also addressed it, so that's cool. But these little changes and that ended up being quite significant. And then I also update the chapter in a few weeks ago before we finished the book about how it's going, so I'll leave that. But it's definitely, you have to do kind of start with identifying, as you say, and then making small changes.
Yeah, I think that's right. One of the habits I identified that really helped me, I kicked off about sort of a couple of, about 25, 30 pounds of weight, sort of 15 kilos a few years ago. And that made a big difference to how I felt in terms of my health. But one of my habit there was that I would buy, I'd buy potato chips, crisps from the garage every time I filled up for petrol. And I would eat in the car on my commute to work, backwards and forwards. And I wasn't even really appreciating that I was doing it. And it was only when I sort of sat and worked it out and realized it was a real, that was a real critical point. And just by doing so, by changing that habit, changing the routine a little, and I chewed gum and bought gum whenever I had a lot of gum in the car for a long time. I chewed gum instead of eating. So I had something to do with my mouth. I had a bit of a reward while I was driving, actually. And it was a real big factor in helping me address that habit.
So yes, we do try and mix your evidence-based chapters and doctor-based chapters with sort of experience and quotes from other people. So yeah, we hope the book's really useful. So I want to now come into talking about the actual writing process, because the book was your idea, and I certainly would never have considered this. So why did you want to write this book, and why did you want to co-write with me? And be honest, because we haven't actually talked about this before.
No, I had that conversation. I think it all came back to, I went on a course in November 2016 with yourself, and how to make a living from your writing, with yourself and Orna Ross in London, back in November 2016. And I guess I wanted to write the book. I had lots of stuff on my hard drive littered around about fitness and health and other things, and I wasn't making the time. I was procrastinating. I was too busy. I was kind of had a bit of resistance, and I was in the middle of a PhD. And Orna stood up at the end and said, what are you going to give up in terms of to do this? And I was like, and I had a kind of a bit of an epiphany. I was like, I'm giving up my PhD, and I'm stopping immediately. I'm going to do some writing, but the writing I really want to do. And so I came away, and then I think Christmas went past, and I gave up the PhD. And then in January, I was making some plans about what I was going to write, and I was kicking around a lot of ideas about healthy writing. And obviously, I was listening to the podcast. I'm sure you must have been given out cues, and you say I didn't have the idea, but you were kind of definitely putting out vibes, I think, about healthy writers and all the health issues that writers have. And I think that was partly because you were relating your own experiences. Mm. And so I had a kind of instant moment where I thought, actually, this potentially could be something that actually would work as a pairing with yourself, with your experience, and as a kind of obviously in that indie community, and myself as a doctor. So I spent an hour writing a short email and just put it to you straight away. And I think you wrote back and said you're a believer in synchronicity about that, the kind of thing, because it had been occurring to you. So I think it wasn't an idea that just flat. It was an idea that was kind of 5 or 10 years for me in the baking. And there just came a moment where I suddenly thought, actually, this potentially could work. But it was a bit of a gamble, because obviously I didn't know you. I've listened to your podcast. I suppose to a certain extent, we all know you from your podcast. Because you are very honest. But I had no idea whether it breaks all the rules of co-writing in that regard, in terms of, you know, working. One rule of co-writing is having a relationship already with your co-writer, your co-author. Mm. And so I was really enthusiastic about the indie community. That was really the way I wanted to go. And I've always said that when I did it. So that was obviously in your position within that community. It was it looked like a good fit.
Mm. Well, and it's so interesting because, yeah, you deciding to give up that PhD is huge. Is a huge thing. And the fact that you were relieved to do it. And I think so often people try and do something like a PhD, or they want to write a novel, so they enroll in an MFA or, you know, Masters in Creative Writing, because they feel like another academic thing is the way to go. But obviously, you chose a different route. On reflection, are you happy that you gave up the PhD?
Yeah, I'm getting increasingly happy. There's still a bit of, you know, it was a difficult decision afterwards, because really I was giving up an academic career as well, potentially. So because without a PhD, you can't go down that academic track. But I was reading Stephen Pressfield's book again, the pro one, I forget the title of it.
Turning Pro,
just a couple of weeks ago. And I think it was very much what he would have called a shadow career. You know, you pursue that. I was pursuing something which was just about close enough that I thought I really wanted it, but actually wasn't really what I wanted to do at all. It was just distracting me. Now, there are so many hours in the day, and I realized that I was losing the hours I needed to get something like this project going.
And I think the other important thing there is that sometimes we have to make space in our life for something new to come in. So you actually have to give things up in order that new stuff will arrive. And I've really found that in the creative space. So just to keep the story going. So you emailed me and I replied. Yeah. And then I basically said, great idea, but I don't know you and I don't know your writing. So how about you write a chapter and then I see if you are, you know, put your money where your mouth is, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
So you wrote a chapter. So how did you feel about that?
I'm extremely nervous, obviously. I'm super nervous. I'm really anxious. I think you're extremely nice about it. There was no sort of pressure in that regard. So, but I was feeling very anxious about it. And obviously, I sent it in, and you were like, "Well, you need to do this and that." It's far too bad. And that was my problem, is that I'm kind of, you so had that academic writer so ingrained in me, and I needed to really pull back from that. Even when I thought I was pulling back from it, I needed to go further in terms of the type of writing that we were aiming at. And so I rewrote it, and I think that probably, and then I think that was part of that kind of process of, we didn't have a relationship before, so actually just working out whether we could fit was in those first few months.
Yeah, we got on Skype. I mean, we obviously we met last November, and then we just met again like last weekend.
Yeah, so yeah, in effect, the whole book's been written without us having, you know, without ever really having met, which is.
But we have had Skype meetings, so that's important. And we also set up a Google Doc very early where we went through how we would work, or we also did a contract.
Yeah, and I think the contract is really important, because I know that you've talked about this, and I think in your co-author book as well, that was really useful, and I was really positive about that, and it was very well written in terms of clarity of what was the expectations and what happened in the future, and so that was all very, there are always weird things that can happen, but most of them are taken care of within that, so actually there's far less chance of sort of dispute or disagreement down the line.
Yeah, and it's so important, because actually, you know, co-writing a book, it's pretty serious. Yeah. I mean, it becomes something, and we do other editions or whatever, it can go on beyond both of our lifetimes. It's longer than marriage.
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Which is kind of crazy, but cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so it's amazing. So the contract, so it was really great in that regard. And we, you know, the table of contents were put together on the Google Doc, and then we were able to talk about it on Skype. Before we got that first draft done, and that, I mean, obviously, I did my first draft, and that was a terrifying moment as well. Sending that in, I really struggled with that because really, I just dictated and then done a little bit of tidying up, but very little. So it was extremely raw, and sharing that first draft stage, I found that was really challenging.
Yeah, well, I remember the first time with Jay Thorne when I did Risen Gods, and I sent him my first chapter, and I was like, I hate this. I don't want you to see this. I'm so embarrassed. But it's, you know, it was important because I also feel that, yes, you were, your voice was pretty academic. And what I like in the book is I think it's kind of obvious, although we have added in markers as to who's speaking. But, you know, we do have different voices, but you have moved very much from where you started. And I think it was around March when you did that first chapter to now, and your voice has relaxed a lot.
Yeah.
So basically you did that draft. Then we used Scrivener. Now, we didn't write in Scrivener at the same time. So you took Scrivener and gave it a first bash, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And so I think that's an interesting the way we use Scrivener, because I know that, say, for example, the bestseller experiment of the two marks, they were almost simultaneously using Scrivener. You can't use it exactly the same time, but there was clearly even one day they would both be at it. But we very much zipped the file up, sent it to each other, had it for a few days or a week or two or however long it was, and then sent it back and forward between ourselves. So we had, and I thought that was, in terms of learning from co-writing, that was a really useful thing, in that I had defined periods where I had a set task with a deadline. And so I knew exactly what was expected of me in that period of time. And that the file was mine and nothing else was sort of moving or shifting in the background.
Yeah. And I think that was important too, especially with the structure, because we did start out with a table of contents, and then we quickly found that the structure moved, and then it moved again as we understood the journey through the book. And although it's a book that people can dip into, you can actually read it cover to cover and get some kind of journey.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it took quite a while to get to that, I think. And that's the obviously the awesome thing about Scrivener is it's incredibly easy to move stuff around. I mean, imagine doing that in a Word document, the pain, if it had all been in a single, it would have just been excruciating. So, but that was a really important bit of getting the book right and making it feel it worked. I think you can just dip in and you can go into two or three sections and get out what you need from it in terms of your particular problems. But if you really want to do the full... You can do the full journey, you can go all the way through.
And then obviously you're not I guess you're not someone who's that experienced in book marketing. And now that's where we are in our journey. We're talking about this. So how are you feeling as someone who basically, as a doctor, you're not, you know, you're not usually like talking to readers and all of this type of thing. So how is the whole marketing thing feeling for you?
I'm tempted to say nerve-wracking and a bit anxiety provoking, but I'm not sure it is. I've been listening to a lot of self-publishing and indie and that, those kind of that's in that space podcast for a long time. So I think everything that we've talked about, I'm aware of, has been happening and I've seen it in action. And I was a bit like, it's a bit more scary than suddenly being the one who has to do it and actually go through that process. That's obviously a sort of a step, but I knew it was coming. So I was kind of in that regard, it certainly is, doesn't come as a surprise, but it is slightly beyond my skill set. We've got sort of some aspects of this creep across into my work with medical journals as a sort of in terms of the media, but actually it's a very sort of specific process. So yeah, it's a little bit out of my comfort zone, no question.
And the other thing is you are trying to now position yourself differently. So, and many authors are going through this with their kind of first book in this area. So what are you thinking with your website and what are you now offering for people and how are you trying to use this as more of a platform builder?
Yeah, so I'm certainly, you know, one of my writing has been about health, and I'm particularly interested in writing about health now for men and their health. And I think it's a very neglected area, and there's far too much emphasis on toned, buff bodies and chisel, you know, growing big muscles. And I think actually that's not what most men want. And I'm kind of really interested in a kind of an evidence-based approach. So I'm based at ewanlawson.com, so that's with EUAN. And I'm offering there a free healthy bloke action plan, which is going to be much more kind of down-to-earth, but still grounded in the evidence, talking about health in some key areas where people can look at their, men particularly, can look at their sleep, exercise, alcohol use, their mental health, like loneliness, and that's such a big issue with men, bit of weight management as well, and they can start making some positive changes.
Yeah, I think that's so good. You know, you and I have talked about this, and I think the healthy writer is very much non-gender specific. It is, you know, for everyone. Yeah. But yes, and I've listened to you go backwards and forwards on what you want to do, what you want to offer the world. And what's so important is you can't be a health person like you and Lawson, health person. You do have to choose a micro niche. And this is what I want everyone to take away is you're going through this process of a micro niche. And that will be the foundation going forward.
Yeah, it's so important. And I think that's probably been my problem. And I'm sure a lot of writers have experienced this. Like the last 5 or 10 years is a lack of focus. And actually deciding having so many projects, so many ideas, and then you're getting part of the way through, then stopping them and never taking them on. And so that's kind of actually this is that kind of requirement to focus on a micro niche and to really work at that. I think I feel very happy that I've found mine and I'm about to push on with that. But I would certainly encourage anyone else that that's the way to start thinking about things.
Brilliant. Well, we are pretty excited about The Healthy Writer coming out. So you can find, the listeners can find the book on all the usual platforms in print and ebook. So where can people find you online?
Yeah, so best place is to go to my website. So that's ewanlawson.com and that's EUANLAWSON.com. And everything is there and you'll be able to find me there.
Fantastic. Well, it's been an incredible journey. So thank you again, Ewan, for your time.
Thank you, Jo.
So I hope you enjoyed the discussion on The Healthy Writer today. And please do pick up the ebook or print book this week and resolve to make 2018 a healthy and sustainable creative year. And coming up next week, I will be doing a personal show reflecting on 2017, what's been happening in the state of indie, as well as whether I hit my own creative goals, plus what I have planned for 2018. So that's coming up next week. So happy writing in the meantime, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.